No, thank you very much. I really have nothing to add. I'm just absorbing all this, enjoying it. Relatively new ham, and I just, you know, just listening. Go ahead, continue. Thank you.
Yeah, because you had signed in the beginning, I thought you probably had a question or a comment. One of the things that I forgot to say, that I say often, is that we all have heard of these nets where people, you have a whole long list of 50 or 100 people all signing in, telling you that you're listening. And it's a good thing to do. It lets people know that there really is a crowd out there. And when it comes to, say, for instance, the information net that Limock holds at 8:30 every Monday night, you get a long list of people signing in. Excuse me. It lets you know who's there and whether or not they're getting this valuable piece of information. You want to make sure you give to all of the major members of the group. In that particular case, a long list of sign-ins is valuable. In the case of this technical net, which has been around since September of 1982, it's been around for 32 and a half years. This is TechNet number 1562. We don't need to be proven that people are listening. We jump to the conclusion, we assume that people are listening because it's been going on for 32 years. And even if not, people are in the direct local area doing the listening. Let me drop. We know that some of those people are doing it by EchoLink and IRLP and all kinds of other techniques. People out of the area are listening to what's going on. So sign-in becomes a little bit less valuable. We used to do that sign-in in the beginning many years ago, and we realized it was a kind of a waste of time. But that was back in the days when the TechNet was only 1 hour long, and people were complaining it wasn't enough. And so it became 2 hours and then 4 hours. And so now it is 4 hours with a hard cutoff at exactly midnight. The machine is literally turned off at my request, because there have been times when these very enthusiastic guys, and it's hard to squelch enthusiasm when you see it, but there are times when the TechNet in the past literally went until the sun was starting to rise again, which reminds me of that crazy expression we used to have in college, when you have these all-night sessions where people are doing cramming for a test, and the joke we used to say to each other, every time the sun rises, you got to change your socks. Because sometimes we'd go around the clock studying the material for fear that you're not going to pass that test and get your engineering degree. And those are the tough days. And in the days that I went to a good New York City school, they literally told you during the orientation class, look at that guy in front of you, look at the guy to your left, look at the guy to your right. They're not going to be there when you graduate. Only 25% of the people who enter the school end up graduating from the school. Those are the kinds of numbers you used to get in tough engineering schools way back in the late 60s. Things have improved a lot since then. And by way of community colleges and whatever, there are ways where there are people who now get a college degree almost simultaneous to getting their high school diploma, if you know what I mean. Okay, anyone else with a question or a comment for the TechNet at this time, give me your call letters, K2IAW listening.
This is KD2ITV. I actually do have a question that generated as a result of your discussion.
Hey, Ken, you were supposed to be number one, and you literally were number two on the runway. Fire away with any question except. Please don't ask us whether or not you should marry a blonde, brunette, or redhead. Would you be happier? I use that as a joke. You're allowed to ask any question you want. You got it, Ken. KD2ICV, K2RIW, the Tech Man. My name is Dick.
Thank you. I enjoy the levity you guys have. As you know, I'm relatively new, but I don't have an HF rig yet, and I'm planning on, I have the space, you know, I have over an acre of property that I can put, so I'm trying to decide whether to put a single wire loop. I've been told like only a loop or like a straight, like a dipole hung between trees, or I was wondering if, does it matter if single wire loop, if it's four-sided, does it matter if one side is longer than the other, as long as you get the total length of, say, the half wavelength, the full wavelength of the wire loop that I'm going to hang up there for the tree. You know what I'm saying?
I sure do, Ken. And a lot of us have been in the exact same spot that you're in. There is no ideal solution here. The simplest antenna in the world is a half-wave dipole with an acre of property. company, oh boy, you've got it made. You can put up a zillion antennas. You can put up dipoles that favor north and south, and another set of dipoles that favor east and west, and some at 45-degree angle. Some of them vertically polarized, some of them horizontally polarized, some of them full round loops or square loops, and so on. Each of those antennas has its advantage and disadvantage. And one of the magic pieces of antenna information that's rarely told to you in any of the good books is that if the antenna is a resonant length, whether it be a full wavelength typically for a loop, or whether it be a half wavelength typically for a half-wave dipole, that's only the magic length where the impedance matching becomes easy. A full half-wave dipole on 80 meters should be approximately 132 feet long if you're favoring something like 3.6 megahertz. Okay? You're lucky you've got a full acre. Let me drop. If I only had a quarter acre, and the diagonal direction of my property only allows me to put up 78 feet of antenna instead of 142 feet, I've now got a much less than resonant length. However, if I've got a broadband antenna tuner, which can re-resonate that short antenna. That short antenna is really not resonant at 3.6 megs where I care about it. It's probably resonant at 5.5 megs. By way of a good antenna tuner, which can take that very high capacitive reactance of that antenna because it's too short, and you go to the right curve and to find out exactly what impedance that antenna is going to give you. By way of the so-called Brown and Woodward curves, and the Brown and Woodward curves are in both locations. By both locations, I mean, all of a sudden I've forgotten the guy's name. Amateurradio.tangovictor, www.amateurradio.tangovictor, or limontechnet.com. You go to either of those websites, with a little bit of searching, you'll find the so-called Brown and Woodward curves. In other words, Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward, way back in 1946. Let me drop.
It's Mike Perry, by the way, Dick.
You said Mike Perry. I misunderstood that. Back to you, John.
It's Mike number one in Jersey, isn't it?
Now you're absolutely right. Mike number one and Mike number two. The two Mikes have these beautiful websites, and both of them have this information. What Mr. Brown and Mr. Woodward did in 1946, it shows every possible length of antenna, of every possible reasonable diameter, and with good laboratory impedance, laboratory equipment, they measured the real impedance of that antenna, the resistive component and the reactive component in the impedance. So you tell me how long your piece of wire is for your antenna, you tell me what diameter the wire is, you look at the Mr. Brown and Woodward curves, and you know the exact impedance of your antenna. You know exactly what your antenna tuner has got to do. What I'm getting at is, if you re-resonate your antenna on your frequency, 3.6 megacycles, in my example, even though the wire is much too short, you will get 98% efficiency. The magic that's not told in any of the good books is that you resonate first, then it will radiate efficiently. In the radiation definition by way of ham radio operators, we want 95% of our energy to be piled into space somewhere at some particular angle and not be coupled into the earth. And so once you impedance match the antenna, forcing it into resonance, the fact that it's too short doesn't matter. Of course that doesn't make sense. That sounds opposite of common sense, I know that. So lucky for you, wire-like antennas are so inexpensive. The raw materials are not very expensive, no matter how much wire you've got in the air, because you as a ham radio operator see wire and your neighbors do not. Let me drop. It's a little bit like the guy who buys a sailboat or a powerboat. It's never big enough. He always wants to go out and buy a bigger one. Well, no matter how much wire you've got in the air, you're always going to want to add more of it at some later time, and maybe take some of it down and put others up and so on. You might put up dipoles and loops that favor east-west and others that favor north-south, some that favor vertical polarization and some that favor horizontal polarization. Don't worry about trying to choose the absolute best antenna for the first antenna you put up. It almost doesn't matter, because no matter what you put up, you're going to be adding others later, and you're going to find out which ones work well for you on your property, on your favorite band, and your favorite directions to transmit. Maybe you want to have antennas that favor your your buddy you want to talk to in London, and your other buddy you want to talk to in Tokyo, if you know what I mean, and your other friend you want to talk to in Chicago. And so don't fuss a whole lot about what's the most ideal antenna. There is no most ideal antenna. Just like there is no most ideal wife to marry. It should be blonde, brunette, or redhead is the example that I use. In all of those cases, the true variables you're playing with are a lot more than first meet the eye. And so there's a lot more going on with that lady you could marry. There's a lot more going on with that antenna you could put up. Just go and do it. In the case of the antenna, where you're not committing yourself to a marriage license and a lifelong contract, if you know what I mean, that antennas are so easy to change in altitude, length, number. You might be putting up others later on with fatter wire, higher altitude, better towers to support them, and so on. So, very similar to what happens. Let me drop this. A brand new ham will start looking through all of the advertisements in the back end of QST magazine, and he's going to find zillions and zillions of transmitters and receivers and transceivers. He's going to say, which one should I buy? And by checking with your friends and going by testimonials is a good beginning. I have a particular philosophy along these lines. Not everyone's going to agree with me. Every piece of electronics I own is used. It was once owned by somebody else. Every car I've ever owned is used. Because I realize that a brand new car, it's got a nice brand new fresh smell, and it's a shiny thing without a single scratch on it, and the minute you drive it out of the showroom, you've just lost $5,000, if you know what I mean. You buy a used car, you don't get that. And as long as you've got friends that know how to fix cars, buying a used car usually is not going to get you in trouble. In the case of this particular club, where you've got guys like Andy, the B2CDL, and Hal, K6DPZ, and others, who can fix anything, even if you buy that piece of used equipment that has a dented front panel because it was dropped down a flight of stairs, but as long as all the electronics is inside and it hasn't been cannibalized and it can be put into working order, it doesn't have to be beautiful. You're looking for function in the beginning as opposed to beauty, in my opinion. And everybody's going to agree with that. But because I buy a used car, if I get a scratch on it because I brush it up against a bush in the process of backing into my driveway, I don't have to worry about it so much. That brand new car, you worry about every single scratch that's going to work into it, that's going to touch it, and you're going to lose an awful lot of money very soon. Whereas a used car, if you buy one that's got a good track record, the rate at which it decreases versus time is very slow. The same with used ham radio equipment. You buy the oldies but goodies, the ones that were that everybody loved that particular rig and they wish they had never sold it. You buy one of those, even though it's 5, 10, 15 years old, 5 years from now, you can still get 80% of your money back if you decide to trade it for something else. So I like used equipment. To me, as long as I have access to people who know how to fix things, there is no such thing as a lemon, with rare exception. There was one particular whole production run of IC, what was it now? Can't even think of the brand name. The one in Belleville, Washington. ICOM. ICOM had one production run where they forgot to remove all the rosin from the solder flow machine. So a couple of years downrange, that active rosin, which wasn't removed from the printed circuit board, started eating into all of the joints of the variable capacitors, started crawling down the leads of the integrated circuits and eating up the junctions of the circuits. And so that particular run of rigs ran into a huge amount of intermittent problems downrange. That's
repeater. Timeout.
That's the one rig that I know of, which I happen to own. I bought it from somebody at a good price, which was a real lemon. No matter how many times you fix it, and I even sent it back to the factory, no matter how many times you fix it, a month later it's going to fail again because this active rosin, which is a kind of acid, is slowly eating through all of the valuable components on that printed circuit board and making the synthesizer and the driver stages and the final stage, everything was becoming intermittent with that particular rig. And so a valuable lesson was learned with that one, and that whole incident occurred about 15 or so years ago. And so hopefully everybody's learned a lesson on that one, and that won't be repeated. So I like used equipment. I can't put up enough antennas. I like radio towers, mostly because I can brag about them, because I get better performance. And so I know that in the beginning, some of these decisions as to what antenna and what rig is not easy. But just go and do it. Check with your friends. Use testimonials as to what they've used, how well they like it. Maybe even borrow one of those rigs and see if you like it, if you know what I mean, before deciding which one. If you decide to buy used or brand new equipment, it's nice to find out something about it. Does it have user friendliness? Is it easy for you to learn how to use? Very similar to what happens when the drop. When an engineer buys a engineering useful handheld calculator, the average engineer very foolishly looks at the list of what functions you get and how many dollars you spend. And you think you're doing the right thing. In my opinion, you're doing the wrong thing. The biggest investment you make in the case of a handheld calculator is how long it takes you to learn how to use its functions. And how well is that screen laid out to be user-friendly. And so that's the biggest investment you make. In the case of the old days where you got a much friendlier machine called Hewlett-Packard, which had a much nicer set of functions inside, but the machine was more expensive. And so, in my opinion, it was a much better investment, even though it was much more expensive than the other brand names. So, what you're really looking for, what parameters you should be considering, is not always obvious up front. You're asking the right questions, Ken, and you're allowed to come back as many times as a new ham. That's the whole reason the TechNet exists, is to take people like you who don't feel comfortable with this subject yet. You realize it's an extremely educational hobby. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio, and I know of no hobby that can be more potentially educational. And so even if 2-meter FM repeater ham radio, which you're doing right now, turns out not to be your favorite at a later time, don't give up ham radio before you try some of the 25 other kinds. KD2, India Charlie Victor. I know you didn't get a direct answer, but I hope this helps a little bit. You got it, Ken. KD2 Raleigh, W in the TechNet.
Center, quarter wave away from the center, half wave away from the center.
center, the outer end of the dipole, with a short circuit in the center. You can feed the dipole any way you want to, and there are certain advantages of feeding other ways. In the case of a full wavelength loop antenna, the guy who used to aid me a lot on the TechNet, K2K and P, no, was it, oh, listen, I'm trying to...
K2KEY.
No, K2KEY. Thank goodness I'm not getting senile and old. He had a full wavelength loop antenna in his backyard, and boy, he thought it was the best thing since baked bread. So there are people who have built that antenna and have very good results with it. And one of the things that he did that very few people have known to do, and that is feeding the full wavelength loop antenna with open wire. How much signal you put on the right side versus the left side of that that ladder line or open wire antenna, of this transmission line, how much signal with what phase angle you put on the right side versus the left side allows you to do some electronic steering. Very few people know that, and Mel was doing that experiment. And Mel is now a silent key. So if you've got enough trees on the property to put up a full wavelength loop antenna, you've got a great advantage, and there are people who have done that who really love that antenna. Let me drop the key.
52 Bravo Zulu.
Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu, recognized. Why don't you give us your name, sir? And it sounds to me like you've got a comment or question on the subject on the floor. Go right ahead. Whiskey 2, Bravo Zulu, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Hard time not getting this going. My name's Rich, and I'm in Riverhead. I've been listening to the TechNet for as long as it's been on. I'm a ham radio operator that's been licensed for 54 years, and I go in and out of the hobby, it seems like, with the sunspot cycle. Just a couple of fast questions. Two of them might sound very frivolous. Number one, about a loop antenna. When I lived in Hollis Hill, Mattituck out here on the North Fork, I put up a loop antenna, a full wavelength loop antenna, and there was nothing that I couldn't work. And I fed it with the open ladder line. It was just unbelievable. Unfortunately, I can't do it now. Here's a question I want to ask. With all the high electronics and high science that's been developed and you guys talk about every weekend and I listen to, why do we still have timeouts on repeaters? It seems like we got things crawling around and out of space, but we can't get beyond a timeout for a repeater. I know it probably has to do with a heating issue. The other question, and this may be the most frivolous question ever asked on the TechNet, what engineers are responsible for designing the connectors I'm talking specifically computers, because as everybody knows, the SATA connector is one of the worst connections, devices on the face of the earth. And I wonder if any of you engineers know who designs these things. That's basically it. Thanks, guys.
You got it, John.
K2WGB, the simple answer to that question is yes, the engineers design it, and the beat counters trim it down to what we have. That's basically what happens.
In the case of...
With the technology, the only other thing about you were saying about new people in ham radio, my cousin who got me into ham radio when I was 12, built everything, including the boxes, and drilled the holes for the sockets, for the tube sockets, way back then. And I went up to his shack once. He was talking to Switzerland. To me, it was magic. I have two daughters now, 19 and 21, and it just seems like radio, and unfortunately, most of the guys on here have experienced that magic. But, you know, with the Internet, there's very little magic, I think, anymore in terms of radio, and that's too bad. Anyway, I'll listen. Thanks a lot, guys. W2 Bravo Zulu.
Great, Brian Rich. The timeout, believe it or not, as undesirable as it is, It is literally designed into the repeater. The electronics of every well-made repeater, you could transmit through it for a solid hour without overheating it, without creating any damage. However, the designers of the repeater have automatically set it up in such a way that they literally set into it a timer of 60 seconds, 90 seconds, 120 seconds, whatever is their favorite number, where it immediately, when you exceed that timeout, the repeater will stop transmitting. Once everybody using the repeater knows that, he knows he must periodically stop talking, take a breath, let somebody else get an edge in word-wise, because an emergency may have suddenly occurred. If you didn't have that timeout timer, a guy might go on there like me, who's very long-winded. Let me drop. I might make a transmission for a solid 10 minutes or 15 minutes. And if 3 minutes into my transmission, some kind of a major emergency took place, like, say, for instance, a 9/11 event, how in the world would somebody be able to use a repeater for one of its major functions in that particular environment? And that is to give people useful information as to what's going on. So that timeout timer was designed in there intentionally that anybody using the repeater knows that if he's long-winded and he keeps talking beyond that point, nobody's going to hear anything beyond the first minute and a half, we'll say. And he, if he knows that, he knows he has to take a breath periodically and let somebody else sign in if he wants to, or break in because there's emergency information. An automobile accident just occurred. So that timeout is something that was designed into it. It's not a failure of the hardware. And the way this machine is now operating, at midnight, this machine gets turned off at my request so that we can limit the length of the TechNet, because there's a hell of a lot of people who got to go to work the next morning. And they would look like bloodshot eyes, if you know what I mean, if you didn't stop it at some time. What some guys do, by the way, some guys can't stay up until midnight, so that they will wait a few days until the recordings of the TechNet appear on amateurradio.tangovictor, and they will load it into their audio device, whatever it is, and so as they're driving to work or as they're on their break, they can listen to the TechNet shifted in time, because they can't stay up that late at night, and they want to hear what took place. So those timeouts are intentional. And when it comes to connectors, the kinds of connectors used on computers, boy, there's a zillion of them. The kinds of connectors that are used on the backs of television sets, there's a zillion of them. When it comes to RF connectors that go to our transmission lines, boy, you got a zillion of those. Each one has its advantages of performance, standing wave ratio, power handling capability, price, and so on. And which ones adapt equally well to fat cables and thin cables. The connector, for instance, let me drop. Eric recognized the most ridiculous connector is the connector that goes on the front end of an extremely expensive high-end spectrum analyzer, vector network analyzer. Hewlett-Packard makes a vector network analyzer that goes up to 110 gigahertz, 110,000 megahertz. That tiny little 1 millimeter connector on the front panel, you can just barely see it. You almost need a magnifying glass to see that connector. And if you break that connector, which is easy to break if you misuse it, it only costs you $5,000 to replace it. That's a connector. KE2EJ, KQIW, you guys are... Eric, by the way, is our local broadcast engineer for remote Channel 13 and Channel 21. You got it, Eric.
KQIW, I just wanted to point out just one thing that you missed. Timeout. First of all, you don't have to have a timer, as long as you identify the timer. Good. But the repeater club, such as ours, most of its members, if I say set the timeout for 10 minutes, maybe two or three people will have the opportunity to talk during the day, and just end up with a way for them to never able to get out. So as a club, we limit ourselves to actually, we don't even let them get it 3 months. But the reason for that is because of IRLP and Echolink, each have their own time is built in. Detroit is a link system. There's a whole lot of things going on. The shorter we keep it, stuff looks better. It's not a technical issue in terms of heating or anything like that. It's just that the various different lengths of timeouts and the various different services, by not overextending yourself in the beginning, chances are you won't blow the whole thing up. And then have to do it.
Yeah, Don, good information.
This is Rich Rosen again. Just want to know if I did some television production over at WNET. If you knew or still know John Gottfried, go ahead. The one last question I have about antennas, too, I just thought I've always wanted to ask, is what if you put a dipole up in your living room? I have, let's say, a TS-440. Is that dangerous radiation coming out into my body if it's in the same room with the transceiver, WTBZ?
You want to take that, and then I'll answer John Gottfried's question. Just an old voice.
Eric, you should know that all of your last couple of transmissions are 60% audio, 40% noise. You're putting out a pretty noisy signal tonight, Eric. Go ahead with your answer on his question. You got it, Eric.
Give me a second while I change radio.
Roger, Dodger. That dipole in the room with you in your living room, 99% of the time, is quite safe from Mr. BC. Rich, this is a very calculatable situation. If you're radiating a kilowatt into that dipole and you're 5 feet away from it, without a doubt, you're pushing your luck. At the usual power levels we run, and the usual length of the dipole, in the case of an 80-meter dipole, because it's spreading its power over across 132 feet of wire, and your body is near the nearest couple of feet of it, you're not sucking up very much of the energy. On top of that, 3.6 megacycles, the magic of that kind of frequencies, the lower frequencies, that the RF energy goes through your body and doesn't stick, if you know what I mean. Your body is very transparent. When you get up to, let me drop it. The most dangerous region is 30 to 300 megacycles. Of all the RF energy, you know, it's VHF frequencies, 30 to 300, that hits your body, 90-some-odd% of it gets absorbed and turned into heat. How much heat that portion of your body is absorbing and it cannot tolerate it, which really makes the difference. RF energy, we call it radiation, because in the early days they discovered that when you put a signal into an antenna, the signal comes out in all directions. The signal radiates. Therefore, they called the process radiation. Perfectly good word until nuclear radiation came along in World War II. Nuclear radiation versus RF radiation almost have nothing to do with each other. Very, very different. Nuclear radiation is tiny little particles close to the speed of light flying out of that nuclear material. And when those particles like bullets hit your body, even though they're microscopic, they're doing damage in general to your DNA. And if you do enough damage, you could create a cancer. RF energy does not consist of particles. It is a wave, and when that wave hits your body, depending on the frequency region, it either is absorbed and turned into heat, or it passes right through and does nothing, or at the microwave frequencies, a high percentage of reflects off your skin. 80% reflects and only 20%, and only 10% of, 80% reflects and 20% goes inside. Let's see if Eric is back. KE2EJ, K2RIW.
I gotta turn that down. Does this sound better?
Tremendously better. Right ahead, Eric.
Alright, the gentleman on Echo Link mentioned the name John Gottfried. John, actually, an avid collector of Rolls Royce, to operate what was known as the TV Lab channel. He did a lot of experimental video, and not so much technical stuff during those days, but late 70s, early 80s, mid 80s, lots of weird things. And that was the day of the video synthesizer, kind of involved in that. So let's send it back to him and see what he has to say.
You've got it, Rich.
Hold on a second. Yes, I'm sorry. There seems to be a delay on my Android phone. Well, then you must remember David Loxton. because that's when I started with Nam June Paik and remember the downtown video. He's still making documentaries. But then there was Global Village, if you remember that. And yeah, I do you remember the group TV? And that's the group that I was a part of, and we made a couple of documentaries, or I did. One was about the Super Bowl, and one was about the Academy Awards. And I used to shake network executives and say, there's gold in just following people around. There's gold. And that they wouldn't hear of it, but that became reality television. And, of course, you know what the broadcast industry in this country did with that. So, thanks, guys. I've been listening for as long as it's on. I'm pretty sure this is the first time I ever chimed in. But though, by the way, those SATA connectors, especially the power SATA connectors, I mean, you blow on them and they fall off. And it just boggles my mind. So I wanted to ask an engineer. Anyway, thanks, guys.
Billy, Sheldon with a comment on the SATA.
Sheldon, we're going to get you in a second. Eric first, KETVJ, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, since mentioned top value television, I was going to ask him if he remembers a handmade video switcher that they used to have, that actually I do. if you remember the Wendy Appel and Bush made them all. It was a lot of fun, you know. It's been stuff started from a few months in those days. It had half inch real machines. Everybody joined CPL Tip Club with actually the Chinese guy. He would sell videotapes at pretty reasonable cost. Everybody would go to him. A fun day. I even had a number of different shows that gone with a couple of artists a long time ago. Thank you.
Which Dick or Rich are we talking about?
Well, why don't Mr. PZ, that particular Rich, go ahead and finish with that subject before we go over to the man from Selden. W2BZ, K2LIW. What time you signed in with us, Rich?
I also forgot to mention a book that came out of that place.
Very disturbing how slow this is on my Android 3. The book I think you're talking about is Guerrilla Television. If it is, it was written by a guy named Michael Schamberg, who actually was the founder of TV, and the only one out of that group who became mega successful. I always knew he would. He's one of, let's say, the top 10 producers in Hollywood. His first film was The Big Chill and A Fish Called Wanda, and he just, you know, made tons of film. And he was in our little group, TV, and there was one other thing I wanted to mention about that. David Loxton was a big champion of it, and John Godfrey did most of the engineering. And sure, I knew Wendy Appel and even Elida Davidson, who very few people then knew last name as Rockefeller. Michael Schamberg had a way of surrounding himself with people of money. And the half-inch tape we used to use, it was, we felt like we were going to bring down the networks. But we did have a great time and made some good TV. Back to you. This is W2BC.
Let me throw this in. If you look in the acknowledgments in that book, you'll find my name.
It's amazing to me that you guys apparently were there at the same time, but somehow never met each other directly. What happened there, Eric? K2EJ? K2LAW?
So, I was always on the outside, so to speak. I was the, one of the people that used to work for, like, you know, the big place. An awful lot of editing to people.
Hi.
Up in the half inch GIAJ world, run from there. It's really a very small world. I used to build the vital trees that came out, stuff like that. So, tiny world, but experimental video in those days, which was not involved. Remember, I started doing television.
And those two movies that Rich just mentioned that you guys were involved with, The Big Chill and A Fish Called Wanda, from my point of view, very well-made movies. Fun to watch, even to this day. The man from Selden, please give us your full call letters and your name, and then your question or comment. I think you guys comment about the connectors. Mr. Selden, K2LIW.
Good evening, everyone. Had a rough day at field day today. Anyway, KD2, Kilo Delta 2, Golf Alpha Golf, Joey Selden. I'm a network engineer and computer technician for 22 years. The power connector and steady connector, I have never broken off in all those years. I can't imagine them being all fragile, blowing on them, or whatever. But if you are connecting and reconnecting and connecting and reconnecting, it's not. I suggest you buy some sort of a backplane and throw the hard drives in something, some sort of a removable drawer or tray. If you're that rough with them that you're breaking them off, that may be your better bet. Go on Newegg and find a raid cage or a backplane cage for 3.5-inch drive and such. I'm going to let it drop for a second. The SATA connector is actually an ingenious connector. It's a direct run directly to the hard drive, unlike IDE, where it needed a master and slave configuration. There's no need for that any longer. It's a direct run, so you get higher performance. And now that SATA 3 is out, you can get ridiculous. Some of these mechanical hard drives can achieve about 220 megs a second individually. That's impressive. You can do RAID much more easily now in a SATA configuration. Plus, and depending on what kind of controller card you get, SAS, if you're familiar with SAS, which stands for Serial Attached SCSI, is also, if you have a SAS controller, you can go backward compatible with SATA. So you can actually both use the same identical sliding connector. It looks a little different, but it's compatible. Back to you, I guess, Net Control. This is KD2GAG.
Ready, Ryan, Charlie. KD2GAG Mobile. K2IW in the TechNet. My name is Dick. Good information. Let me ask you this, though. Which one of the field day sites were you at? And lucky for you, you didn't get any rain, right? The whole idea of field day, really, is to practice under adverse conditions. Can you set up emergency equipment with portable power in the rain? We were really tested this weekend. So, which one of the field day sites were you at? And did you order that rain, Joey? KD2GAG, Mobile, K2IW in the TechNet?
Yeah, I was at Great South Bay Amateur Radio Club over in, Lindenhurst at Babylon Town Hall. I did not order the rain. It was ridiculous. It was, Saturday evening was the worst. We lost one of the tents. It kind of blew apart. And it was, since we had it all bungee cord and all that stuff, we had to tear it down, cut it to get it down. It was just a disaster. I ran the mesh nodes and everything there. I got IP phone technology going there as well. We had an IP camera up on the boom. It was pretty cool. We're going to be doing a lot more mesh technology and stuff in the future, setting up more IP telephony stuff. But over to you, the group.
KE2EJ recognized. And when it comes back to you, Rich, I want to ask you, how late were you at Great South Bay Field Day site? Were you there during the teardown this afternoon? KE2EJ, K2IW, and then pass it over to Joey. You got it, Eric.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention that part of the advantages of this, actually, this is really designed to light and drive. The other thing about the connector itself is the connector is huge. Right? The actual data rates that are passing through that are pretty high, and it's not like a cat cable where you have a couple of twists. The cable binds to a reasonable length, not that long, but it's a constant type of cable and connector, so you don't get any ringing, you don't get the phone.
get some. And I was a 5 month old baby. Yeah, it was kind of wet, but, you know, the guys got everything together.
No, it's through my little DNA on the triplex that they used.
It works, but it also has a little bit of reflected energy coming back at you.
It's very interesting.
Well, I know you came to check.
Whiskey 2 Bravo Zulu. I don't know the timing on Echo Link and my phone, but Eric, I worked at Unitel. I'm sure you remember Teletape and Teletronics and a couple other I'm forgetting about. And I was a cameraman at the time. And Teletape was in the same building, only 3 or 4 floors, as a record plant. And that's how I got to meet John Lennon. And on July 31st, out here on the North Fork, at one of the wineries, for the first time, I'm going to exhibit, and I've never before seen John Lennon photographs that I took at a session one night right before he broke up with Yoko for that year. Anyway, W2BZ, thanks.
Oh, man, now, we must know each other. In the day of Rush Limbaugh and Sally Jesse, the FDL, and MC Munn and all that good stuff.
Rich, W2BZ, that question was directed to you. I wonder if you heard it.
I did hear it, but again, I'm having a lot of trouble with my phone and Echolink. Anyway, I mostly hung around with the Teletape crowd that did Sesame Street and the Mike Douglas, not the Mike Douglas show, the a few of the talk shows, but mostly my friends were at Teletape. I were at Sesame Street, and one time I got to go into Jim Henson's townhouse workshop, and you're talking about a genius having millions of dollars to play with. It was just incredible. It was just incredible. But Bill O'Coin, who directed this series, went on to, his next thing was on, he went on to discover Kiss, the group Kiss. And he asked me to come out on Long Island and tell him what I thought of them. And I said, Bill, they're the worst thing I ever heard. And Bill just died a couple of years ago, but he was a director at Teletech.
You got it, Eric.
All right, I got it. Yeah, I'm sure we've crossed paths, so I used to be, the night in the morning. I think everything was. But it was also in the days of Omnibus Computer Graphics where they had that equipment. Anyway, maybe I should catch up one day. One of my good friends, Josh White, went on to be a very rich person, too, so. Anyway, back to you, Dick. We'll do this some other time, some other place. Oh, Dick, by the way, did you get the email that I wanted an explanation to talk about last week?
I think I did, but I haven't thoroughly reviewed them yet. I haven't been near my computer for quite a few days, Eric, so I'll catch up with that. And Joey, KD2GAG, you were at Great South Bay Field Day site. I wonder if you were there tonight at around 2 p.m. during the teardown. Over to you, Joey, K2RIW.
Yes, affirmative. I was there at the takedown. I was there pretty much since Saturday around 1 o'clock in the afternoon, left around 10 o'clock, and then came back this morning at 7:30, and then continued on. I left around 6 o'clock today. And anyway, I just wanted to say that I've been listening to your TechNex for quite a while now, and you're a very, very educated man. I'm quite impressed with your vast of knowledge that you have. I definitely enjoy listening to your verbiage every time you chat. I'm just quite impressed. And if anybody want to look me up, I'm on QRZ, KD2GAG, if anybody was interested. And, well, I got a lot of photos on there of my man cave and stuff, and my pretty much, you know, I'm a computer guy. I've been doing it for a long time. So if anybody has any questions about anything, I can pretty much answer anything you got. So this is KD2GAG. Over to you.
Yeah, during the teardown, starting at around 1 o'clock, lasting to around 2:30, 3 o'clock in that order, you remember seeing a guy walking around incognito He was wearing a black shirt, a black hat, and black pants. Do you remember seeing them? Because all of your crew was wearing white shirts that said Field Day operator. But do you remember seeing that guy walking around with black clothing? Back to you, Joey.
I sure do. That was the gentleman who was selling two radios, Pro 2 and a Pro 3. Don't tell me that was you.
That's a big 10-4, good buddy. That was me. And yes, I wrote down your email address about the 756 Pro 2. And so you and I will be talking. Yep. As I said, I traveled incognito. That's the first time I've ever been to a Gizmark field day site. Too bad you and I didn't get a chance to talk about the TechNet. And so if I keep paying you, Joey, will you keep saying those testimonials about the how much you appreciate the TechNet? And you may know that the TechNet itself won a fairly nice prize way back in 2010. The board of directors of American Radio Relay League gave them the Technical Assistance Award that particular year. Back to you, Joey. So too bad you didn't know who you were talking to. We should have had a further discussion. KD2GAG Mobile, KQRIW in the TechNet. Glad I met you.
Yeah, same here. Now that I know who I'm talking to, I can actually match the face with the voice. Yeah, it was a pleasure talking with you. Yes, it was a shame that we didn't chat a little longer, but yeah, we were in the middle of the breakdown and getting all those ICOM radios. You know, there were $60,000 of radios there, so we had to, you know, make sure to secure them well and make sure they're getting ready to get back to, you know, shipping where they came from. But yeah, beautiful radio. 7851, 7600, 7700, 7800. Oh my God. It was ridiculous. I can't believe what kind of powerful radios we had there. It was like a kid in a candy store for us. It was unbelievable. What a great day. All right, I don't want to take up any more of you guys' time, but yes, you don't have to pay me to tell you how good you think. You should definitely get an award for 2011, 12, 13, and continue. Yeah, I'm quite impressed. If you want to chat more or whatever, shoot me an email, and I'll give you my cell phone number. We can talk all you want. KD2GAG, listening.
Those rigs that you're describing, Joey, boy, they sound like almost beyond what the average ham radio operator will buy. Sounds to me like they were on loan to you. And for those who really want to see an extremely serious field day operation for the last, I don't know how many years, the Great South Bay Amateur Radio Club, their particular field day site had a man lift device that went to 85 feet, and about 15 feet of mast was on top of that with a 6-meter, 2-meter, and 450 antenna on it. They had a 40-meter three-element Yagi that's done with wire and ropes, beautiful design of an antenna, as well as another tower with a tri-band beam on it. So a very serious arrangement. You guys really go far out, and I think I heard that he came very close to 5,000 QSOs during that rainy field day event. And I know that it was the food tent that got blown away with the wind, and your donuts got wet, and also water poured into ground fault interrupter for the food operation, and interrupted power. So you guys had some valuable lessons learned as to what the rain can do, wind and rain can do, but a very serious arrangement for a field day operation. I think it was close to 5,000 QSOs. Isn't that true, Joey? KD2GAG, K2RIW in the TechNet?
Yeah, that would be affirmative. It was quite a bit. I know over in the 40-meter, 80-meter, and 20-meter tent, we were over around 1,400 or so by the time 2 o'clock rolled around. But, yeah, there was also on that 80-foot boom, now you bring it up, we had a voice over IP camera up there, which video recorded everything up top there. We had a Rocket M2 and the whole setup up top for the mesh was like $400. The Rocket M2 with this monstrous antenna on it. You got to see it. It's so big, so fast. I think it's 13 dB gain on that darn thing. And the Rocket M2, I think, was like 730 milliwatts by itself. So you guys can figure out the wattage, the effective wattage output on that was nuts. So we had a bunch of other nodes in every tent. Next field day, we're going to go a little bit more elaborate. We're going to put an IP phone in each tent. because I got I was running a free PBX on a Raspberry Pi 2, which is a quad core 900 megahertz, and we had a phone in. I'm not sure if you saw it. SHTFLI was also there with their bus, and I had pretty much every all the nodes and everything were pretty much in there. Access points, a couple of nodes all over the place just to extend it. We also were running. I'm gonna let it drop for a second. We were also running CSIP on the Android phones, which were able to access an access point that was connected to the mesh, and then we were able to get phone calls from two cell phones connecting to the mesh access point, which then was able to get to the Grandstream voice over IP to analog converter, which is also connected to the PBX. It was great, man. It was a great day. It was a great proof of concept. Next year is going to be better when we open up some sort of a port, and we're going to get inbound and outbound calls across using Google Voice connected to the free PBX thing. It's unbelievable. We're going to be going full force on this mesh, and hopefully we can get you guys connected to it as well in one day or another, and make one big monster mesh on Long Island. Back to you.
It's beginning to sound like you're going to take up RF electronics and computer electronics and networking and running field day sites. It sounds like you're going to take that up as a hobby, Joey. It sounds like you're going to start getting serious. I'm having some fun with him. Quite an operation. Very well done. A number of the operations on Long Island were very well done, but Gizmark obviously looked to me like they did quite well. Alrighty. And with any further questions or comments on all of the above, before we go over to the mailbag, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
Dick, I have a question from EchoLink.
Fire away, John.
Okay, we have a ham down there, Roberto, who has posted before, call sign XE1GXG from the great state of Jalisco, Mexico, has a question on ceramic resonators. So why don't we give him a chance, see if he can get it. KC2WGB, back to you, Dick.
Okay. We'll stand by then for XE1 GXG, I think it is. Alberto, I think it is. Go right ahead with your question. K2RIW in the TechNet. My name is Dick.
Okay, hi guys. Hi Dick. How are things going up there? Nice to hear about Field Day. Haven't been on in a long time. I was up in Canada for several months and back here in Guadalajara. And I asked the questions about ceramic resonators. Ceramic resonators, what are they good for? You know, I do QRP home building here, and I kind of want to know what I can use them for. What are they good for? Back to you.
Okay, I did work with these for a military job. It happened to be part of the B-1B bomber. Ceramic resonators, there's very many kinds of resonators, but the ceramic resonators, the ones that I was using, were made out of an exotic material called barium tetratitanate. And that kind of a resonator has extremely high dielectric constant, something like 100, as I remember. And when you're using a resonator made out of material of a dielectric constant of 100, and you take the square root of 100, it's 10, that means your resonator can be cut down 10 to 1 in size, and if you use just the right mixtures of barium tetratitanate with other kinds of doping materials inside, you can end up with a resonator at frequencies where you can't possibly operate a crystal. Let me drop it. The ceramic resonator is not quite as high in Q as a quartz crystal. A quartz crystal, if you really pull out all the stops with a quartz crystal, you can get a Q of 1 million. In other words, you've made an oscillator of 10 megahertz, and the crystal itself will have a bandwidth of 10 hertz out of 10 megahertz. That's what a Q of 100 means. And ceramic resonators are not quite as good as quartz. However, you can easily make a ceramic resonator at 1 gigahertz, 5 gigahertz, 10 gigahertz, 15 gigahertz. You can't do that with quartz. You can just barely get to 150 megahertz with a seventh overtone quartz crystal. And when you get beyond about 120 megahertz, they start getting very touchy. So quartz crystal resonators for a reference oscillator